Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm thrilled to be back with another Master Clinician episode. I have with me someone who was just lauded by his trainees as a true Master Clinician, nominated by several people, and I want to read some of those nominations. I have with me Dr. Scott Licata, who is an attending anesthesiologist at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, and let me read some of the things that were sent him. Here's one quote. Dr. Licata is special because he is clinically talented, sharp, and calm in a crisis. He is also uncommonly kind. I recall distinctly having a senior resident friend of mine tell me that he had a very big case and a medically complex child with a brain tumor, and how thankful he was that Dr. Licata was the anesthesiologist assigned. He's the kind of person I want to be when I grow up. Here's another. Dr. Licata is an attending physician that is truly beloved by all. I'm so fortunate to get to work alongside him and learn from him. He is the type of attending that you feel at ease when they walk in the room, and he can always put a smile on your face. And here finally is another. He's the one I want to in my corner when a case is hitting the fan or an incredibly unstable kid rolls through the trauma bay. He's constantly teaching little tips and tricks in the OR to keep making residents better. But beyond that, I can't even begin to say what a great person he is. He's brilliant, humble, kind, and I can only hope to be half the anesthesiologist he is. Well, that says so much, and I can't wait to talk with him. Scott, welcome to the show.
Wow. Thanks for having me. That those mean a ton. So thank you for reading that and letting me know. And thanks for letting me be here. I'm a longtime listener. I'm really was honored when you reached out to do this and flattered. Like you said, I'm at the University of Pittsburgh Children's Hospital. I'm one of the peds anesthesiologists for the majority of my time. A brief period of my time, I do clinical informatics as well. And I think that kind of bleeds into the work as far as how I think about the ORs, how I think about cases from a system standpoint. But yeah, I'm super honored to be here.
Well, my pleasure. And clearly this is all well-deserved. Let me ask you to tell me a little bit more about kind of, you mentioned some clinical informatics that you do. So what exactly does your kind of day-to-day look like, and how did you get there where you are now?
So I took a kind of roundabout path to medicine. And for about 5 years before medicine, I did programming. I was a computer scientist by trade. And then in residency, I did residency at Stony Brook University Hospital on Long Island, where I grew up. They gave me some time to do like visual analytics and some QA, QI, pulling data from the EMR using those other skills from my past life. And then when I came to Children's in Pittsburgh, they offered me some time to, if you do 25% of your time for 3 years, you can be grandfathered into a clinical informatics board specialty. I do that about one day a week, working with the chief medical informatics officer, whether that's predictive analytics or QA, QI for the hospital or the department, writing different extracts to pull things from our medical record system.
Awesome. So when we were talking about this beforehand, you kind of thought, well, it might make sense to go through, you know, a case, a pediatric anesthesia case, and that you could hit kind of a lot of the things you wanted to share by going through the different stages, pre-op, intra-op, post-op. So why don't we do that? Tell me how you want to start. Take us through kind of a case and set it up for us.
Sure. So yeah, I thought that maybe going through all the steps would make it a little structured for the listeners. Because peds has its own nuances as far as interacting with the child and the family. And so some of the pre-op and induction and airway and then access might provide a little bit of a structure and learning. So I thought, you know, if we think, okay, so we've got, you know, a four-year-old coming for kind of a standard ENT tonsil and adenoids procedure, let's say something somewhat bread and butter that really anybody, whether you're going into peds or not, might interact with in your practice. And you're going out to same day to meet an anxious family and an anxious kid. And some of the ways that I approach it are, you know, trying to interact with the child themselves. You have like a lot of anxiety going on in the room and a brief amount of time to get them on board and get that trust. I am a big proponent of Versed. I think from a anxiolytic standpoint for the child, but also for the family, it makes a big difference. And I defer a lot to the family's expertise of the kids in the preoperative setting. engaging them in some of the decisions that occur, I think helps families get on board with the care. And I'll routinely tell them, you know, I am not an expert in your child. My role is to do what is safe for them, but you are the expert in the child, and I won't let you do anything that's not safe. So many families, you know, I recommend Versed, and many times families are like, yep, we're on board with it. And sometimes you get families who are unsure, or we get a lot of, behavioral or combative kids sometimes. And then it becomes a discussion of like, hey, we're only going to fight once. Most of our kids, as you probably know, many kids are mask induction. So this 4-year-old is going to be a mask induction. And then we'll put an IV when we're asleep. So that's already taken some of the stress off the table. But sometimes they say, hey, listen, like, he's not going to swallow. This verse said, it's going to be a fight. And like I said, I usually tell them, like, we're going to fight once. So if you think they're going to spit this out, then we're just going to do the mask. But if we can do the verse, I think it makes a big difference. And finding common ground for the child it becomes important. Whether that's video games, whether that's, you know, I carry a lot of superhero things on me, but I've never met a kid who didn't love a device. So I keep the streaming services on my phone. But that combined with Versed is a wonderful distraction and anxiolytic in the stress of the perioperative period. And then it's not uncommon to have a parent who says, like, you know what, I still want to come back. And we deal with parental presence a lot in that setting. And one of the things that I find helpful, because for me, it's about the kid. And if I think the child needs the parent, then that's okay. And if I think they don't, then it becomes, I think this is something people run into a lot, like the struggle between a parent wanting to come back for themselves versus for the child. And one thing, but parents want to be heard, right? Families want to know that they're part of the care. And I think they're also worried that they have to come back, or they're not doing the right thing if they don't come back. Lots of the pre-op phone calls that I've seen, like, across the institutions tell them, like, you can be back there with the child. So they feel like I can't leave my child. I'm supposed to be there. So one thing that I find useful is telling them, like, listen, we're going to make this about your kiddo. I'm going to try the verse ed. And let's see how they are. And then we'll get you in that suit, that bunny suit, if you want to come back. But down as we're moving towards, we have a hallway between our preoperative area and the operating rooms. Tell them, we're going to start to separate. And if the child reaches for you, then they've shown that, like, they're not separating well. And if they don't, then you get this free bunny suit. You can take it home to paint in and you've allowed the child to make the decision without asking or forcing the child to make the decision. And the families feel heard. They feel like they were given the opportunity. One of my mentors, Dr. Cladis, talks about how when you allow parental presence, your like parking scores go up and your food scores go up, which is just a crazy thing. But I think what it points to is that families want to feel heard and involved in their care.
Let me clarify a couple of things. For those of us who haven't done this in a long time, when you give Versed, how much do you give and how far, like, do you give it and then come back and talk later? Do you talk, then give the Versed, then come back to get them later? Like, what's the timing look like?
Sure. So usually, I try to give it 20 to 30 minutes. I was always taught you need 10 minutes for amnesia and then you start to get the sedative, aspect after that. I shoot for 20 minutes. Sometimes that takes a lot of planning. I will often order my Versed kind of the evening before and time it and then call the nurse after I've seen the patient and, you know, say like, okay, we're good. You can give it and allow myself the time for that to kind of get in. So it takes a little bit of planning. And then from a dose standpoint, most people shoot for oral Versed, 0.5 milligram per kilo. I tend to go up to 0.75 per kilo. The dose range is 0.5 to 1, but I find that some kids spit out a little. And if you spit out a little and you got 0.75, you probably get 0.5. And so that's usually kind of where I shoot to be. If a case is delayed and now you're 40 minutes in, it's okay. Kids tolerate it well. It's pretty or say it's your first case and heaven forbid, like there's a reason that a surgeon can't do the case. It's about an hour of just, hey, we're watching you, and then they can go home. So I don't really stress giving it ahead of time. I stress giving it too late. The only time some kids can have paradoxical reactions, and I warn the families, I tell them, listen, this medicine is like a few too many drinks. And you've all seen someone who've had a few too many drinks. Some people get silly. Some people get sleepy. But some people get mad and angry. But nobody remembers. And that's all I want from this medicine, is that they don't remember. And that way, because it's the truth, if the child has a paradoxical reaction, it's really hard on the family. But the child doesn't remember. They're, you know, the Versed's still doing its amnestic aspect. And it does, it is unfortunate if then like you have a wait or a delay. But really stressing the amnestic portion of it as my goal for it, from both a, if the child were to need another procedure, stressing or reducing the stress of the separation. But also we know that, you know, giving Versed ahead of time reduces regression behaviors in the week following procedures. So sometimes we have these kiddos who've recently learned, you know, not to wet the bed, and then we see that regression afterwards. That's usually the timing I shoot for and how I explain to families.
Awesome. And you know, one thing, so my wife's a pediatrician. I see this with her. I've seen it with pediatric anesthesiologists, that you guys are really good at just, you know, even if it's like at a random party and your friend's kid is there or whatever, like just talking to, like initiating conversation with a kid. Like, I'm not good at that, but like you guys do it all the time. You're good at it. Are there, you know, little, do you have like go-to phrases? Do you, you know, what do you, what's your initial approach? Yeah, I'm sure it varies by age, but if it's like, you know, in that, I think it can be tough if it's that kind of 4 to 6 year old range, like they're old enough to talk, but you know, not, they're not like a teenager who you could probably just talk about sports with. Like, what's your approach to initiating a conversation and kind of talking to a kid that age?
So every kid likes silly. So I mean, my first go-to is silly, regardless of what that is. You know, whether it's, and sometimes you let the kid lead it. You know, I'm like, all right, we're going to, you want to watch a movie or a show before we go back? Like, what do you want to watch? Let's get it up on the phone. You know, hey, if my wife texts me, tell her she's in her own operating room. Like, you just, you know, hand over my phone. And then sometimes that guides it because you know their interests. Like, what are you interested in? And we have wonderful child life people at the hospital too. And sometimes they, you know, key you in like, hey, we're doing this activity or this game. But I find that kind of explaining things to the kid to start in a calm way. So I usually tell them, hey, we got 5 things to do today. All right, we're going to do a drink. And I tell them, like, you don't get, I don't, they don't let me taste this drink. This is the Versed. So you got to tell me what it tastes like. And, you know, I got to know what to tell the other kids. So, you know, the last kid told me this tastes like strawberry with a yuck. But some kid told me it tastes like popcorn. Like, so I don't know, like, I need your help. And then you're co-opting their investment. And then, so we're going to do this drink, and then we're going to go back to this other room, and we're going to put a sticker on your finger, right? Prepare them a little bit for the pulse ox so that they know what's happening. And then we're going to breathe through a mask. Are you breathing? Like, you probably breathe every day. And they're like, yeah, I do. And I said, so you're already doing it. And then we're going to take a nap, and then you're going to have something to eat. I was like, and then, you know, these are your 5 things. Anything scary? Do you have questions about any of those things? And sometimes they do, but it de-escalates kind of the stress because they know what's happening. And then I'll turn to mom and dad and be like, hey, like, in addition to that, while we're snoozing, little IV goes in to stay safe, you know, and then we'll talk about breathing tube and that. But for the kiddo and the conversation towards them, they're like bought in. And then it doesn't so much matter what you say, as long as you keep interacting with them, right? It's that like ignoring them that I think builds the stress. We often get people come out and they call it talkesthesia, right? It's like this like just continual conversation, and they lead it and they interact, but silly works. I talk to them. I'm like, hey, do you have any pets at home? And then sometimes even before they respond, I'm like, do you have a giraffe? And they're like, no. I'm like, why not? Why wouldn't you have a giraffe? And it's ridiculous. And they love it.
Yeah, that's awesome. So it's that kind of stuff that I think comes so naturally to some people, but it's good for folks who maybe like me, who it doesn't come so naturally to have some of those strategies. So thank you for sharing that. All right. So you had kind of gone through, you know, we've given the Versed, we've had this conversation. And now anything else before you're kind of taking the kid back to the OR?
I mean, we got a video queued up, the Verse heads on, mom and dad are going to walk back with us. And I'm like, and this is really where that conversation with the kids starts, right? Now you're like, we're talking, you are distracting both through pharmacologic means, a device, I find extremely useful. And then just a conversation. And this is where some of the conversation, relative to induction starts for me, whether that's about pets at home or, if it's a kid in this age range who's into space and stuff. I've seen really nice inductions where you're like, all right, you know what? We've got this space mask and we're going to go and we're going to breathe that and we're going to go off to space. And sometimes creating a story for them from an induction standpoint that's consistent with their experience is really effective. So we start taking them down the hall. We're talking about pets or in this age range, like 4 to 5 or space. Lots of boys are, you know, they're in there, they're like planets and, you know, what's your favorite planet? All right, so we're going to go blast off. We're going to breathe our space mask and you get them into the room, over to the table. And this is part of why I like the Verse head too, because they're oftentimes a little sedated, a little silly, so your jokes are funnier. And we start to, you know, breathe through the mask and tell them, you know, if you're going to go with the space kind of storyline, like, all right, so you might start to, you know, feel kind of the rocket ship shake and you shake the bed a little bit. And again, it's about keeping the story kind of consistent with what their experiences are. And then, you know, you might start to smell some of the rocket fuel and we turn on the sevoflurane. And then, you know, you might start to feel as you're blasting off and the bed is still rocking, you might start to feel the pressure from the rocket ship because, you know, if you've ever, you feel kind of breathing against 8-liter flows on your mask or 4-liter flows if you're being kind. And, you know, that pressure that you're feeling and you might start to feel dizzy as you're going off to space. And then you're coming through the atmosphere and you get some of these precocious 4, 5, 6-year-olds, they know like, oh, this is the stratosphere. And you create this conversation and they slowly kind of close their eyes, move, kick a little bit. And it can be a really nice induction when it goes in line with them. And it's not always that way, right? I mean, sometimes they're like, I don't want that mask. And this is sometimes where we have discussions with the trainees, you know, what to do if it doesn't go as such a perfectly smooth mask induction as they sometimes don't. I think part of it is just speeding the child through that experience rather than this negotiating that can sometimes happen in this disinhibited state. I remember early in my attending career, I had a 9-year-old who didn't want it. And I spent more time than I care to admit trying to negotiate with them. And I quickly learned that the amount of time I will spend negotiating that is really as long as it takes for the time constants of the circuit to prime. And that's it. And that's when you know, like 8% SIVO blocked mask and we're going to, okay. And then it's on. And sometimes, I think sometimes people feel hesitant about that. But they have Verset on board. There's an amnestic aspect, but making the process as swift for them is a reduction in stress for them. Sometimes you have those kids where you need to just, it's a fully primed 8% SIVO circuit and the mask is on and you roll with them, the kind of head side to side. But it reduces the time of that induction for them and smooths that experience for them.
Yeah, that makes sense. Is there an age at which you start doing a pre-op IV or does it just depend on the kid?
It depends on the kid. So we have some really experienced like 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds who are like, I want an IV. I've had a mask before. Smells terrible. I want the IV. Usually when they start to be around 9 or 10, I'll talk to them. Hey, you're old enough. Here are your choices. There's two ways we can go off to sleep. You know, one is with this mask and there's no pokes, but it can be stinky. And one is with an IV and there's a little poke. It's quick. It's small, but there's no mask. And, you know, either is safe. I let them choose. And then once you get old enough to where it's less safe to do a mask induction, then you get less of a choice.
Yep. Fair. Okay. So what about intraop? What are things that you're teaching, thinking about once you're there and you've induced?
So some of the things at the start are really just like have a reason for what you're doing. So if we just like step back to the induction for a second, sometimes people do kind of these graded inductions. They go to 2%, 4%, 6%, 8%. And sometimes that's fine. But sometimes you have a kid who's like really out of it on verse ed, and 2%, in my opinion, smells just as bad as 8%. And sometimes, again, this is like you're prolonging it. But sometimes you have a kid with Down syndrome and you really want to be mindful of the bradycardia that can occur from a mask induction. And then in that setting, kind of grading your induction makes a lot more sense to me. And so oftentimes as like we start these cases with the trainees, I really just want to know, like, why are you doing that? There's so many ways to do things, right? And this comes up with oral boards and stuff. Like, there's lots of ways to do it, but I need you to be able to verbalize, like, what's your reason for doing that? I see so many people come, they start in their training, they read some of the PEDS stuff, and they've got nitrous and SIBO on. And I was like, okay, but why? Right? 8% works pretty well. What do you need the nitrous for? And so that becomes like a, you know, have a reason. I hear second gas effect a lot in that setting. But clinically, from that standpoint, 8% SIBO and Versed works pretty well, and not so much getting into the environmental aspects of nitrous, but also just the like B12 pathway, the demyelination aspects of nitrous. Sometimes I'd like you to have a reason why you're using it. It's no different for us in PEDS than like oxygen, as far as you have these neonates who have intracardiac shunts, PDAs, and if you're keeping them on 100% oxygen for longer than you need to, you're lowering their PVR and potentially risking over-circulation for them. So I first stress, you know, to the residents, like, everything is a medication. Everything should have a reason. So we've got them asleep, and now we're talking about kind of access on these kiddos. Oftentimes we teach, you know, blind saphenous, kind of medial malleolus, dropping your thumb over and kind of angling towards the mid calf, as kids have, you know, anatomic locations that generally have veins. So your saphenous or the lateral sides of your the dorsal aspect of your hand are kind of our go-to relatively blind techniques. But ultrasound more and more as kids are heavier and heavier, is a wonderful tool, particularly, you know, in this setting. Again, let's say we have this 4 or 5 year old for, you know, a TNA, and they've got sleep disordered breathing, probably because they're a little heavy more than like necessarily their tonsils or things like that. So ultrasound can be a real saver in these kids, reducing the number of attempts for venous access. Things that I see people kind of mistakes they make in this setting. One of the most common ones is, you know, these vessels are fairly small. And I think people come from a world of like trying to reduce the amount of gel they put on because it's pain and it's messy. But the less gel you have, the more pressure you need to get a good image. And the more pressure you use on a kid, the more you compress the veins and you make it harder on yourself. So kind of finding being a little liberal with your ultrasound gel can help you as far as needing less pressure and seeing the vein better, particularly when you are starting out with ultrasound guided access. These kids, we use winged IVs. So one of the things in whether it's ultrasound guided IVs or with intubation that I find is when you think about the amount of movements that you can make in adults, we get residents come up and they're like, oh, I'm good at, you know, ultrasound guided IVs in adults. And I'm like, okay, but your movements have to, like, you have to grade them down. They have to be smaller. And many of the techniques that we use in adults come with movement from your wrist. So if you imagine how you hold an IV or how you hold a laryngoscope when you're doing procedures on adults, you're using your wrist to do that movement. And so that if you can put the point of movement closer to the blade or the IV catheter, it makes for smaller movements. So rather than holding the IV catheter on its sides and move with my wrist, I try to use my thumb on the back of the IV catheter to create the movement. And this, you know, this is no different like levers and fulcrums. The more you move the fulcrum towards the liver, you get finer movements or less movement on the end. And so I find this helpful for the IVs. I hold the wing with my pointer finger and my thumb on the back of the catheter, and I move my thumb side to side as opposed to the wrist. And that allows for some finer movements from with ultrasound-guided IVs.
Ask you, Scott, or point, I'll agree with you and say that one of my most salient memories from my peds rotation as a CA2, which was my first time doing peds anesthesia, was that I was very, I was halfway through CA2 year. I was like, I know how to intubate. I was very, you know, confident in my intubating. And then I come to peds the first day and we had some baby. And I remember I go into the mouth with the laryngoscope am I holding it with the wrong hand? Like, what's happening? I couldn't see anything. I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, I haven't had this happen to me in, you know, since early CA1 year. And I was like, okay, I don't know, it was a fluke, whatever. And then it kept happening for several patients. And what I realized is exactly what you just said, which is that I was going in, I was halfway down the throat, you know, before I even stopped to look. And so the movements are so much smaller, and you have to, it took me a while to learn that. I think it's just a totally different thing. Some of the skills that you can be very good at with adults, you have to kind of relearn completely, at least for little babies.
Yeah. And the little babies are, right. It's just another end of the spectrum. They have a lot of things that adults, you don't encounter with adults. So like, when we talk about intubation, right. I talk to all the residents, how your adults that you're coming from, because like you said, we have CA2s, that's usually when you do peds. And sometimes you're doing it right after right at the start of your CA2 year. So you haven't done any of the subspecialties yet. And now it's like, hey, do peds, which also does the subspecialties. And so the stress is there for them. And then you have this little baby. And I think there's a lot of stress and anxiety about that. But they feel confident about their intubation skills. And what you have to recognize is some of the differences in the kids. So your adult larynx is at C4 and your kid's larynx is usually around C2. And we try to draw a triangle, right? And then your hypotenuse to C4 relative to C2 is much steeper. And these are the things that make kids have those like anterior airways. And if you think, you know, what tricks can I do so that I don't make that worse? You already have this steep hypotenuse that makes them look anterior. So the things that I think about are, you really got to get that tongue out of your way, because if the tongue is sitting midline and you're under it, you're just creating a steeper angle for yourself and making your life harder. If you're holding the laryngoscope like an adult, where it's in your palm and your thumb is up against the handle, you are, again, you're moving from your wrist. So rather than holding the laryngoscope like that, I hold it between my pointer and middle finger on the blade side and my thumb on the side facing me. And so it's really just fine movements. And again, if I wiggle my fingers, I can move the tip a lot finer than if I'm holding it like I would an adult and I move my wrist and you have a lot larger motion. Other things like kids, they're small mouths. These little kids, you don't really need to put your hands in their mouth and scissor them, right? It's take your thumb and just chin down. You have that Phillips 1 blade. In general, I tell people Phillips 1 is my favorite blade for kids. And it's from 1 kilo until you're about 5 or 6 years old. And then when you're 6, 7, you can graduate to a Miller 2 blade. And then when you're a teenager, you can be a teenager and an adult and you get your Mac blade. But you hold that Phillips 1 really low. You come in at kind of sideways on their mouth, if like 45 degrees between like their chin and the angle of their lip. And you just rotate your hand like a J to push the tongue all the way off to the left. And as you go in, kind of rotate and down and then look. And lots of people come and they're like, hey, this is a straight blade. I need to pin the epiglottis. You don't. It's okay if you don't. you go in, you're a little deep, and you come back and you wiggle your fingers a little bit as you come back, because that larynx can sometimes just be caught by the entire blade and pulled up. But if you can wiggle your finger, sometimes you can sneak it down and it kind of comes down and down. And what I try to emphasize for the trainees is, like, I don't really want you to find chords. These little babies, you can't really see their chords. They don't have your classic adult pearly white vocal cords. What I want you to find is arytenoids. These are like identifiable structures that everybody has. And if you can train your brain to see arytenoids, you'll know where the trachea is. If you, you know, you put that blade in a little kid, you're a little deep, and you lift your hand up, you're going to stretch the esophagus into an ellipse. It's going to look exactly like a trachea, except that it doesn't have arytenoids. And so if you can teach yourself, find the arytenoids, go above the arytenoids, it's where the trachea is. It has to be. And whether that's in an emergency where they're doing compressions, then you track. You can see the arytenoids going up and down, and you can, without having to necessarily stop compressions, you know, find it and put it in there. But that's a structure that is consistent regardless of their age, as opposed to those like chords that people look for. So reducing your angle, looking for the arytenoids, holding the blade lower to reduce the amount of movement at the tip of your laryngoscope are the like three things that I like to see the residents starting to do as they're learning to intubate these kids. They often ask, you know, when do you stylete a breathing tube and when do you don't, when do you not, right? Because oftentimes in peds, we don't. And my general answer is, I want you to stylete the tube when the time it will take you to find the stylete and put it in is too much, because it's a lot easier to take the stylete out than it is to go find it, grab it, open it, put it in, stylete the tube. So really little babies don't give you a lot of time from an apneic standpoint. RSIs, where, you know, you don't want to then come out and sit there and mask them, these are like reasonable times to stylete the tube, as opposed to other times where you can try with a unstyleted tube. And then if you need to, we can grab it, but it's a lot easier to take the stylet out than it is to go and find it. So we've now, you know, you've got the tube, we've got the kid intubated. We talked a little bit about access. But some of the other, just from an access standpoint, differences that I find in kids, you know, their tissue is very elastic as opposed to adults. So oftentimes, not necessarily in this TNA case, hopefully, but from an arterial access standpoint, people reach for arrow catheter kits. And those are not my favorite in children. They tend to accordion on themselves because of the tissue in kids. And so we'll oftentimes just use angiocaths for arterial access. You know, from an ultrasound standpoint too, it's a similar technique. If you're going to use the ultrasound for arterial access, in that, you know, you get in, you lower your angle, you are tracking that bevel, you know, that center white dot within kind of the donut of the vein or artery, and you're tracking that up and up until it's in. You'll often, whether it's arterial or whether it's central access or venous access, you'll see kids tent their tissue, and you'll look like you're in, but you're really tenting this very elastic tissue. And so some of the movement is, you know, kind of a fine jab and then a little pause and a fine jab, or, you know, this staccato movement for access, in order to both pierce through, but also give time for the blood to kind of go through the catheter. Cause you can imagine you have this little 24 gauge, angiocath or 26 gauge, in the NICU. It takes a little bit of time for the blood to traverse there, and you could move through it if you're moving too quickly. And if you're not doing that staccato kind of movement, you do see these kids, you know, you come from an adult world, you're kind of just pushing forward. You just tend to push the vessel out of the way because of you know, these kids have youthful tissue. It's not that like nice kind of calcified one that you got to really jam through, but it doesn't kind of push out of your way.
Yeah, that's funny. I do the exact same thing you're describing with adults. I just think there's no downside and the potential upside of, you know, not missing some that you would have missed. So yeah, I'm all for that. Great. We talked about tips for IV and A-line placement. What else are you thinking about intra-op?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks. If you've ever been listening to a patient's heart and lungs in pre-op and wondering if there's some mild wheezing or a faint murmur, you are not alone. I used to struggle with this all the time until I got my echo. Honestly, listening through an echo is like night and day compared to a regular stethoscope. That's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies heart and lung sounds up to 40 times, and there's noise cancellation to cut out distractions. I can't emphasize enough how amazing it is when you can hear so clearly. And you can unlock murmur and AFib detection powered by Echo AI, along with sound recording and sharing for earlier diagnosis as well. Echo is backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for devices and AI algorithms. Those who use it are 2 times more likely to detect heart disease. I can't tell you how much better I can hear hearts and lungs in every area that I work with my Echo. I trust Echo so much that I worked with their team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/ACRAC. Your purchase is HSA and FSA eligible and may qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you'll detect heart and lung conditions more confidently. If you don't, return it for a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/ACRAC for $50 off plus a free chest piece cover. That's ekohealth.com/ACCRAC.
You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
All right, and we're back with Dr. Licata.
So you're thinking about kind of your ventilation strategies. In this case, if it's a tonsil for sleep disorder breathing, kind of like we're talking about, I generally extubate these kids deep from a control over the airway standpoint. And many, you know, our ENT surgeons are fastidious about their bleeding, so it tends to be a very dry airway. So we work to get the kiddo now back kind of breathing on their own. In a setting where you can use whatever FiO2 you want, an effective way really is you're just trying to build up their end-tidal CO2 increase, you know, to whatever their apneic threshold is. And we're a little more liberal about this in kids than we are in adults. In general, increased cerebral flow and carotid flow in a kid, they tend not to have carotid plaques or things that you're really worried about from that standpoint. So in a case where you had free rein on your FiO2, you know, I'll often go up on my FiO2 to around 90%, increase my flows, wait till my end-tidal FiO2 is around 50, and then just turn the vent off. And now you're, you know, kind of apneically oxygenating them with your flows, but you are not ventilating them. And they come back pretty well and have enough kind of reserve as well as apneic oxygenation not to desaturate. And then, you know, you can put them on PSV or depending on kind of where you are in the case, build up their FiO2 or build up their end-tidal SIBO until they're at a range where you feel like they're safe to extubate. And that range, you know, some people still sit there and they're like, oh, you need to be at like 1.3, 1.2 MAC to extubate them. But I'm much more of a proponent of just kind of looking at the kid, evaluating whether they're reactive, you know, a jaw thrust and if they breath hold or things like that. Because oftentimes you've given narcotic, you probably given Presidex if you're taking care of a kid, because we tend to do that a lot. And there's you know, lots of other things that go into their anesthetic than just what their entitled SIBO is. So in this case, you know, for this proposed case, it's a kid I would extubate deep. And
why is that, Scott? Why would you extubate him deep?
Oftentimes for the tonsils, depending on kind of their age range, I find that it gives me a little bit of control over them as far as coughing against the tube. So if I think that they are dry and not at risk for laryngospasm, so I'll, before anything, I'll look in their mouth. I'll put a little pressure on their jaw because there's a lot of irrigation that they use, and that will bring it forward. You know, the tonsils are obviously lateral, so I'll suction just midline along the tube just to make sure that they're dry. But you know, you have a kid who's waking up screaming sometimes if, you know, their pain is inadequately controlled, just agitated in a general sense. So I find that it is a smoother and safer wake up from kind of an airway standpoint. I do try to stress that a deep extubation is really, you shouldn't be doing it for speed, because the second you have a spasm, your speed is gone.
Yeah.
So it's not like, hey, I'm doing this for turnover time or these things. I think that in the setting that it is appropriate for, the case and the child, then it's, you know, a smoother emergence for them, without the tube when they've already had kind of intraoral work. As opposed to as like a palate where I don't extubate them deep. I don't want them crying, but I don't extubate them deep because of the amount of oozing and things that are after like a palatoplasty is done. And then, you know, we think about, how we're going to, just kind of stepping back, interrupt, how we're going to ventilate them during the case. People come and they look at the minute ventilation for these kids, and you've got this little kid, say, who breathes 30 times a minute, right? And so if you're breathing 30 times a minute, then like every other second, right, you're in like this inspiratory phase. And from a preload standpoint, right, your positive pressure is inhalation, and you're kind of affecting your preload. So you're always, or you're frequently in this phase of positive pressure and affecting your preload. So it's not uncommon that we will shoot for a little higher tidal volumes in order to lower our rate, so that even though for each of those volumes, maybe you impact it, you're spending less time within that inspiratory phase. And so I find that many people that I practice with shoot for more of an 8 to 10 range tidal volumes. And that's different for the trainees as they come from the adult side and implement some of those lung protective ARDS-NET strategies in these
Interesting.
Kids.
Yeah. Okay. And that's, there's no, I mean, I assume kids' lungs are very pliant, right? They're not, it's probably, you're not really in danger with those higher tidal volumes of causing damage, unless they maybe have some sort of congenital problem with their lungs.
Yeah. So certainly, I mean, this is a discussion separate from like CDHs or things like that, where you have an issue with your lungs. So I think they tolerate the volume. In fact, you know, kids are the spectrum of age, but kids tend to follow the law of Laplace, right? Small airway is more prone to collapse. So really your lower volumes increase your risk of like a more pronounced atelectasis, and difficulty. There's no different really. The second after that kid gets intubated, I find a recruitment strategy for them, or recruitment maneuver for them is helpful, because even the amount of time that it takes to put the breathing tube in, even if it's swift, they've de-recruited and you have atelectasis and you're kind of fighting your way back. And it's, you know, the smaller the kids are, the less their reserve is, and law of Laplace, the smaller airways. So you end up fighting that recruitment, fighting that atelectasis much more commonly.
Awesome. All right. So that's how we think about kind of tidal volume, respiratory rate. Other things intra-op?
Some of the things, like if you're struggling in this setting, just since we're talking about it, I find particularly in the smaller kids, sometimes it's really difficult to listen to the chest and decide, you know, so you're struggling with your tidal volume, you're like, maybe I main stemmed, right? But you got this little kid, and so you're like, all right, maybe I main stemmed. So you're going to listen, and you listen on both sides, and you're like, I think it's bilateral. But the smaller the kid is, the more easy it is to hear, you know, the contralateral side on that side. I find that palpating the cuff, so putting a little pressure in the on the pilot balloon with one hand, and then gentle pressure on the neck. And I find the cricoid with gentle pressure, and I work my way down until I feel kind of the point of maximal intensity on the hand holding the cuff. Gives me a tactile sense of where that pilot balloon is. You don't want to push hard. There is some literature on like injury that can occur from that, but gentle pressure. And if you can locate the balloon, or the cuff kind of at the sternal notch, then you can feel confident that you are below the cords, but that you're not in the right main. So I find that like, that's a useful tactile confirmation for me, that it's that it's appropriately located within the trachea. And this is like helpful too for those situations where maybe listening is hard from the drape standpoint. And then we talked about the recruitment maneuver. And then obviously, you know, smaller tubes more prone to clogging. So when you get down to these 3-0 tubes, I find sometimes people just don't think about like the impact that a mucus plug can have on these kids. And, sometimes just suctioning the tube gets missed in the stress of like, this kid is desaturating and I'm not sure what's happening. And, is it a shunt? Is it, this? And you just need to suction the tube. That's it.
And how do you suction three? I mean, my memory of a 3-0 tube is it's tiny. I mean, do you have a suction catheter that fits down that, or how do you suction out a 3-0 tube?
Yeah.
You do.
Okay. Just smaller suction catheter.
Yeah. Okay. They exist. Good. Just making sure.
Yeah, if you have it. Ideally, if you're taking care of one of those kids, you have those stocked.
Okay, good. All right. I could imagine, like, do you have to, like, hook up your something to the outside, right? You know, I don't. Okay, so good. So you just do the same thing as you do in adults. You suction out the inside of the tube. Okay.
Yeah. And then trying to think of other things from an intra-op standpoint and ventilation. No, I mean, I think it's a lot of what we said, you know, protecting against this de-recruitment that kids are more prone to. Kind of just being this part really not different than adults as far as just being systematic, whether your system in these settings is like from the patient back to the machine, from the machine back to the patient. But just having like a system of things you check so that like those simple things like suctioning the tube don't get missed. But main stem is, you know, is a pretty common thing just because the amount of movement that you have is a lot less in these smaller kids as far as the degree of, you know, how far the tube can go to main stem them. And that can, you know, you might have this child kind of in an extended position for your intubation, and then you flex their head or just put their head in a normal head ring and now you're main stemmed. So just being mindful of like the position that both the procedure will be done in, so that, you know, you're not in some flexed position, as well as, you know, what the depth of your tube in a neutral position, are helpful as far as like reducing that, because nobody loves having to readjust it once things have started or the drapes are up.
Absolutely. All right. So intra-op, we've thought about some good stuff. How about, you know, we talked a little bit about emergence in terms of extubating deep. Anything else around the kind of transition out of general anesthesia, or should we go just to the post-op?
So I think part of the transition out, you have to kind of make a little bit of decision about where that's going to occur. So you have a spectrum of kids, right? You know, preemie kids who are no longer premature and like DPD, and these chronic lung diseases that these kids might carry with them. I'm trying to figure out what season kids aren't sick in. I haven't found one yet because they seem to always be sick. We have varying degrees of how liberal we are with doing procedures with a URI or how close to a URI you might be. So a lot of those go into the decision about like where that transition out of general anesthesia occurs. You know, I think that you have to kind of consider all those things in addition to the surgical factors and the patient factors when you think about like, okay, am I going to Am I going to put a tube in or am I going to put an LMA in? You know, am I going to put a tube in, but I'm going to take it out deep, you know, and just treat it like an LMA? Do I even need to paralyze the kid for this? Because there's many, you know, kids that we don't need to. And one difference than adults is that paralysis, in addition, plays a big role in the anesthetic as far as reducing the amount of volatile that you need, so that you can maintain a blood pressure in a small kiddo and have them tolerate the procedure. Obviously, you want to reduce their stress response and things like that. But the ability to, you know, maintaining a blood pressure is one of the more, most critical things in these small kids who often don't tolerate volatile anesthetic. And now, you know, talking more about these, the really, really little kids, sometimes you need to rest on paralysis and, Bursette and fentanyl and a small amount of volatile anesthetic. I find that sometimes trainees are hesitant to turn down the gas as you've come from an adult world. And obviously you don't want to do that in that setting. But I often say, you know, if you don't, you know, the kid's going to have a problem. So, and then from a post-op standpoint, some of the nuances in kids that we encounter, that are different from adults, really center around behavior, emergence agitation. So emergence agitation and delirium is something we encounter pretty frequently in children. It's one of the benefits, I think, to having a recovery room that's specifically pediatrics. Like as we talk about the difference between, you know, you and I were talking about how hospital systems that have like freestanding pediatric hospitals relative to kind of the combined, having a recovery room that's accustomed to agitation, having parents who are prepped for the risk of agitation, so that they know like, hey, this can happen and it's okay. I try to frame it, or refer to it similar to a night terror. It's harder on you than on the kiddo. They don't know what's happening. But you know, it's normal. They're safe. And having that conversation even before, you know, in the pre-op area is helpful. I think that the stress of it is a big reason why we see in most children's hospitals Precedex being utilized frequently. And I find that, you know, if you, it's a great rescue. And obviously, depending on your setting, whether it's like ambulatory or things like that, you do have to kind of think about your length of stay for these kids in the recovery room and what that means for the family. They'll often, you know, some families will tell you like, oh, you know, we spent hours here because he wouldn't wake up. And you look back and they got Precedex. And sometimes we tell you, oh my gosh, he woke up too quick. And, you know, the packing nurse told me he woke up too fast. I'm like, okay, what are we going to shoot for here? You know, if they're experienced, do you want, you know, was the agitation, if they've had it so bad that you want them to sleep longer? Because we can do that. Or do you want me to not give it? And then only if we have emergent agitation, then I can come and give it. But then that's going to prolong, kind of likely prolong how long you're sitting in the second phase. But I find for, you know, for example, these tonsils and things like that, if I give it on induction, that tends not to, because now you have the procedure time for it to also sit and the standard recovery time. It does reduce the incidence of emergent agitation, but that seems to be the best way to also have the least impact on, you know, their length of stay.
And how much do you give, Scott?
So the loading dose is kind of what, if you were going to do an infusion, right? And this is kind of what we base that on, is 1 per kilo. We get them in 20, you know, it's 4 mics per ml and you can get 5 cc syringes. I don't think anybody really does 1 per kilo across the board. Most people from just a standard one are probably giving 8 to 12 mics, just even, for your 5, 6 year old. This is not like your NICU kid who does not need Precedex. This is a ambulatory healthy kid who's going to the recovery area. They looked at UPMC Children's, they randomized tonsils to saline or Precedex, and all the laryngospasms were in the saline group. So in addition to emergence agitation, and it makes sense, right? It's increasing your MAC to some degree, reduces your risk of laryngospasm for deep extubations for these kids. So I find that Presidex on induction, narcotic on induction for the tonsils, and Tylenol and steroid on induction are kind of my tonsil adenoid induction medications. Because I extubate them deep too, I make an effort to try to not give propofol on induction, because sometimes the attending is going to sit down and it's a 2-minute tonsil. But we'll give propofol if we struggle with the intubation. But generally those meds plus the volatile anesthetic are perfectly fine for intubating. And then if you do have emergence agitation, I mean, so much of it is, your presence there with the families, kind of explaining it and helping them through it, because sometimes it's just, we need to wake up through it. And sometimes you need pharmacologic intervention. And it's also making sure the kid's safe. Not going to hurt themselves as they thrash around, reassuring the families that it's normal, providing kind of like a, if it's like, hey, we really don't want you to give anything and we're safe, we're just screaming and crying, giving them kind of a safe, isolated space, reducing the stimulus, lowering the lights, things like that, to help them kind of move through that emergence process.
Nice. So there's a couple of things that that kind of came up when we were chatting and going over things earlier. I want to just ask if how this applies or what you teach about it. How about growth and grit? What is that? How does that come up?
So when we were talking, I think about why, how do the residents encounter pediatrics? And like we said, you come as a CAA2 and you're either at the very start of your CA2 year. Sometimes we even get like late CA1s, and approaching these small kids in a setting where you felt confident from your adult skill set, and now you have these setbacks. I know I could intubate before. I know I could put in IVs before. And a lot of that, is disheartening. I remember being very disheartened by it in my pediatric training. And recognizing that in our trainees, and emphasizing, whether it's that you'll get there, right? From a growth mindset, like you can get there. This is not, a thing you can't do. You couldn't, you learned how to do it on adults. And from a grit standpoint, being persistent with it, pushing through kind of, you didn't get that one, so we're going to do this one again. It's not like, oh, you didn't get it, so we're not going to do it. So I try to have an open discussion with the residents. Like, it stinks. It's really frustrating when you don't get it. You're going to keep trying to get it. And, we're not going to sit here and I'm not going to make you do, 10 IVs and we're going to delay the case until you get it, right? There's also a discussion like the case needs to move on. And so we're going to create opportunities for you to get it. Some of that for me, like as an attending, comes into how I manage the room and how I try to build in time so that we can protect those things, the things that, we want to work on. But I try to be mindful of, how the residents are meeting this training, where they are, and emphasize like that you can do it. And, some people come at it with grit and a growth mindset, and sometimes that requires some work and reinforcement. But I think it's important not to lose sight of kind of where the residents are in their training, as well as how hard it is to have what is a perceived setback. Like, I can intubate and now I can't. I can get access and now I can't. Sometimes that's difficult to recover from, but more than that, sometimes it's difficult to recognize that in a trainee.
Yeah, for sure. How do you help people to find joy in their work?
I think, I have the benefit of working with kids. It was a huge reason that I ended up doing peds. But that silly conversation the ability to laugh and joke and have that have a positive clinical impact, I think is invaluable. Whether it's a complicated case or a simple case, like they all have weight. They're all somebody's kid. They're all a child. And there's a lot of stress, I think, for people around that. But if you can find the joy in the interaction and find the humor in kind of how you approach the family, how you approach the kids, and how you, you know, have these kind of de-escalating moments where you make it calm, I find a lot of joy in the ability to do that, to create that environment, and to see the clinical impact that that has for the kids and for the family. But I also think that if you create that, if you look for the fun in it, it opens a kind of a psychologically safe space to learn. And to say like, hey, for the trainees to say, hey, like, why didn't this work? I find that it's a lot easier to have that discussion, like, hey, you know, you didn't get that intubation and stuff, when it's there's a kind of a jovial kind of aspect to the induction, right? You're joking with the kid and stuff, and hey, you didn't get that intubation, and here's why. And, you know, granted, it's, you can't always be funny. And there's, you know, certainly serious times, but when it's appropriate, having the ability to have fun while doing it, certainly, I think, makes the education easier.
Yeah. And I think we could probably learn a lot in the adult world from that. You know, it's a little probably easier in peds where you're, as you say, you're joking around in pre-op with your patient all the time, to transfer that to like applying joy to the learning process too, whereas it can be a little harder, I think, in the adult world. But we should probably learn more from you all. When you say that sometimes it's important to question authority, what do you mean?
I think that, you know, if you don't know why something's happening, you should ask, you know, like, in the same way that like we were talking about, like having a reason for why you do things. If you're not sure, you know, why you're attending is, you know, choosing this blade or choosing to manage it this way, blindly just following doesn't teach you anything. I remember in training, I had an attending who people were so scared to work with, because like, it was extremely particular, and like, oh, I don't like working with him. But I found that I never really had a issue, because anytime he was particular, all I asked was, why do we do it this way? Like, what have you learned? Teach me why this is the way to do it. In general, people have an experience or a reason, you know, why that's their practice, why that's what they think is the best way to do it. It doesn't necessarily mean you need to agree with that way. But particularly as a trainee, where you're trying to find, I mean, part of the goal is finding the way that you're going to do it, particularly, you know, with our fellows, where, yeah, you know, you're choosing to be here to do this extra year in peds. What I want for you is figure out, like, you know, how are you going to do this? How will you practice? You know, asking kind of why, and, you know, if you can then, as you build your repertoire of these are the different ways I've seen, then also, you know, trying your own ways and saying like, hey, I know you like to do it this way, but I'd like to, can I try this way? Allows you to kind of build your skill set and your practice. And then, I mean, part of like when we talked about that, from just the bit of me that does clinical informatics, gets, from an attending standpoint, gets frustrated when systems are like, oh, you have to do it that way because that's the policy. And I'm like, can you show me the policy? Because I think we use that a whole lot, that term, or the systems use that term a whole lot. And it's rarely the case.
Yeah.
And from like a wellness burnout, just moral injury that we experience on the workforce and that front, making sure that that's really something that you have to be doing, I think is important.
Yeah. Yeah, no, completely. And I think, you know, the other advantage of, if it really is the policy of having it, is you can decide whether you want to try to change it, right? But first you got to know, is it actually a policy? Yeah. Totally agree. Scott, this has been great. Anything we didn't cover that you want to cover before we move on?
No, I think it's been great. I really appreciate you being, you having me here. Appreciate being here.
Awesome. Well, let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have anything that you would like to suggest the audience check out for fun?
I do. Well, I got two. So one for me is that I think I found a resource that allows you kind of to follow different journals. I always struggled, like, how do I stay up to date on a bunch of different journals at one time? To scroll them kind of like social media. So maybe people have this, but it's called Read. It's an app. It's by a company called QXMD. And if you are like on your hospital's internet and you can then like the journals, you know, you get the free access to the articles, but you can choose journals to follow. And then it kind of brings up the most recent ones and you can kind of scroll through or search topics. I find it a super useful one just to stay up to date on peds and some of the surgical specialties.
Nice.
I like that one. And then from a lifestyle standpoint, I hate to cook. I'm really bad at it, but I like to have some variety in, you know, food, and to make it easy. I have two kids who, they have wildly different tastes and will choose at like 7 PM to be like, I want salmon. The other one's like, I want tacos. And I'm not good at cooking. So there's this company called Cook Unity, and you can pick some different meals. They're like prepackaged. You just heat them up, and it makes my life like it allows me to spend time with my kids, allows me to bring one for lunch and just heat it up at work. And it allows like a variety of food in my life that then I don't have to spend time. And it is not overly expensive. So from like a trainee and resident standpoint, where like ideally you're eating healthy, but not, you know, spending your time grocery shopping or doing those things. This has been a huge changer for me as far as my intake. So
awesome. Yeah, we do the same thing. We use Factors. I'm sure it sounds like it's a very similar thing, but yeah, it's amazing. It's really liberating to have that as an option.
That's the right word for it.
Yes. Awesome. Well, I'm going to recommend a specific spice, actually. So this goes, you know, back to if you actually ever do some cooking, but this is something that is so easy. And, you know, just throwing a little bit, I find like if I'm just going to stir fry some broccoli or something like that, that having my kids don't normally like it, but I found this spice is by Burlap and Barrel, which is a fabulous online spice shop with really fresh harvested spices. And they make a purple shallot powder. And It's, you know, oniony, but different. Like it's a little sweeter. Shallots are a little sweeter than onions. And if you make some broccoli, you put some salt. If you like pepper, some pepper and some purple shallot powder on top. Man, like my kids who normally don't like broccoli will eat this. It's really delicious. You can put it in soups. You can put it in anything. So on the days when you don't use your prepackaged food coming in and you want to make something or you want to supplement it with some extra, you know, vegetable or something, try this purple shallot powder from Burlap and Barrel. All right, Scott, awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead, and Sophia Wu is our social media manager. William Mao is our production assistant. Thank you so much for the great work that you do. Our original ACRAG music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAG podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.